questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. One of the leader's biggest challenges is to be able to express their vision of change in the way that other people get it, enough to begin to see its significance for them. If not, they simply won't act, and the leader's vision of change won't be realized. Jonathan already knows how important language is. In answering this next Amplify question, he sees that the words he would use could actually turn others off and discovers how to prevent that. We're joined in this conversation by Brittany, another member of my team.
What don't they get about this? What don't they get about this? To communicate so that others hear us and understand us, we must see where our choice of words could impede us. Do they get your vision? If not, how can you express it differently so that they really do? For me, the first bit about not getting, this is about language, I think, is the power of words, particularly charged words, but how they can so easily be misinterpreted, or where the same powerful word, and I'm thinking of values here, words that are charged with meaning and emotion and are very personal in some way, how they are certainly not guaranteed to give the, they don't guarantee you the response that you might be hoping for. We've talked a lot about truth, you know. So if the question here is, what don't they get about this? Here, the choice of words is difficult. As you said yourself, Marianne, is it truth that, with a big T or truth with a small T? And that matters, because people see it with a big T, and you can say it with a big T. We know how you do that in a speech. The more abstract it becomes, the more you're dealing with the big T, the truth. That's going to put people off, I think. I would expect it to put people off or lead them down the wrong path. When I know, for example, for me, there is a very day-to-day practical aspect of truth. I want to write it with a big T. I want to say it with a big T. But there are branches on this tree, the tree of the vision. There are branches which are very practical, and which I hope would appeal to a wide number of people, even if in the first instance they're a little bit squeamish about, ooh, truth, Sunday school, church, is he lecturing me? So that's my first reaction here. Big words. I need big, powerful words to be in there, full of emotion, full of meaning, charged. I want that, partly to grab people's attention, partly because the first meeting has to be about emotion. It just is about emotion, so you need to embrace that. But I can immediately see the dangers, and these particular words, soul. I'm very committed. I'm very wedded to the word soul, because it gets to this idea about this very sacred, unique nature of each individual, a sacred dignity that doesn't need to be earned. You don't need to earn it as a child or as an adult or as a worker or as a voter or as a member of this community or that community. You have that from birth because you are a human being. And the reason why soul is important, as we know, Marianne, we've talked about this, is because we have to borrow language sometimes from religion, because our dry, legalistic, secular language just isn't enough. It doesn't get to what we're looking for. So human rights, fantastic. Human rights, yes, that they're high on my list of priorities for any community. But where do we get them from? what's the soil, what's the beating heart underneath the 16 chapters of European human rights? What's underneath that? It's the child and the beating heart of the young child being born into the world, and who comes into the world with this dignity. Now, the way I've talked about that, I know is going to put people off. People say, oh, well, yeah, you, human rights, I like that. But then when you got into the child and the dignity, and oof, we're back in church again. Yeah. So this is where I'm... I'm not going to back down. You see, I'm already attached to my vision. I'm not going to back down. But I do understand that the language is important here, and that it will impede.
Yeah.
It will turn some people off. It will be too heavy.
Well, turning off, you need to be aware of that absolutely, and it needs to guide what you say. In this question, it's what don't they get about it? What do they not understand? So when you speak of truth, for example, what could it be that they don't even understand, they don't get? For example, the importance of truth, what truth is.
Yes.
I was trying to identify the source of the quote, there are certain truths that are inviolable, and I can't find the source. But, you know, as you've said, even on the truth front, there is an anathema, a reluctance to truth, a distaste for truth. So if you start talking about truth as a valued thing, what could they maybe not get about that?
Sure. I think what they would not get, I think the risk is that they are distracted by something which is overly moralistic in their eyes, in their ears.
There you go. They might think you're preaching at them.
Precisely.
Wouldn't they get if they thought you were preaching?
Well, I think, and this takes us, I think, in a very healthy manner back to the previous card, where the cards are bleeding into each other rightly now, and in
that was deliberate.
Feeding off each other. It's where I would try and help here is to say that this is not this is big highfalutin language, but it's not only that. There are some very practical things. You know, I want to celebrate brave people here, so this is not just about pious values and what is good in our society. It's also about brave, really brave men and women who have held the corrupt to account, corrupt politicians, corrupt business people, people who have gone into a war zone to report on war, people who have reported on the mafia in this community or the mafia in that community, judges who have sat opposite extremely dangerous, violent criminals, or the jury in the room. So human bravery, good people, could be your son, could be your daughter.
During the pursuit of truth?
Yes.
While truth was being pursued,
yes.
They bravely
did
what they could to facilitate it.
Absolutely.
To uncover it, discover it. So preserve it.
Exactly. So I can imagine, I'm already going into sort of political mode here, but, I want to defend and celebrate our brave young women and men who fight in our Navy and our Army. But I want to celebrate our journalists too, because they have fought for our country. We've not always seen it. They don't always get a medal. We don't always remember their names, but I want to celebrate the women and the men who have gone out there and put their lives at risk to get to the truth.
Mm-hmm. And reputations, even when not their lives, that, you know, they've had to defend a point of view.
Make or break.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
Their careers, yeah.
Absolutely. So, raising it to that level.
Yeah.
But in a practical way. This is not the church. It's brave women and men who have put their lives in danger to get to the truth. And that's good. That's good for you. You and your family and your neighbors, we've all benefited from that.
And that's another point to make, yeah? So if you answer this question, what don't they get about this, from, first of all, the broad vision, the whole, the sphere of your vision.
Yes.
What would you answer to that?
from that first exchange we've had, I'd say what they don't get immediately, some, would be that there are really very practical day-to-day manifestations of this.
Okay.
Yeah?
So it's more than an ideal, it's more than an abstract.
Yes.
It's concrete.
Yes, yes. And okay. we'll provide, I hope, new ways of seeing the work that people do in different parts of our lives. Again, I think I stumbled on this morning, and I'm going to stick with it as a pin to myself, which is an important part of the vision is not just what's going to happen, but it's also getting us to see things differently, changing the way we see things. At the moment, if I look at some of the countries of the West at the moment, countries that were at the forefront of the free press 200 years ago, who have a great noble tradition of newspapers, the plummeting trust, the way in which trust has evaporated in journalists generally. And okay, let's not get into a discussion about why it's happened, but I think we can agree it's just a really bad starting point that we're in here.
Well, one of the elements of trust, as we've described it, is believability. So if you can't believe what you read, what you hear, and if people don't believe what you say, they will not even be willing to entertain it as a possibility.
Right. And it's not just journalists and judges and the citizens sitting in juries. It's across every part of society where it's the pursuit of the truth that matters. So again, to allay the concerns of somebody who might feel a bit squeamish, ooh, this is a bit, there's a bit of lecturing going on, it's a little bit too pious, this truth business. It's the idea that across our society, in all parts of our society, when we together are at our best, we're pursuing the truth. We don't necessarily get there. We don't necessarily arrive, perhaps not even after a lifetime. We may get there and end up disagreeing on what the truth is. But the fact that we want to pursue it.
That you value it enough to pursue it.
That's what matters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that you can trust in the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you know it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, what won't people get about the vision in its first exposition, its first expression? They perhaps won't get that this is about all of us. This is really about all of us. We're not looking to one part of society to give us the truth, to deliver the truth, or to possess the truth.
Pursue it together.
It's a way of life.
Yeah.
It's a way of life. And it's not about perfectibility. It's not about trying to become perfect. It's not about a race to the truth, because every scientist will say, I won the race to the truth with this theory. And then 1 year later, I was proved wrong because my colleague found a theory that was better and disproved me. So the noble tradition of admitting that your theory has been superseded by your colleague's discovery is a wonderful thing.
So if that's the broad... Again, what wouldn't they get? What wouldn't they understand?
I think what they might not get here, and I'm looking for the general here, is that they might not see that there is something for them and all of their family and their neighbours and their community. This is not about, you know, if we stick with the truth part of the vision just for a second, it's not about delegating the task of pursuing the truth to those people in our society who have a responsibility to get to the truth.
Thereby relinquishing your own right.
Right. For example, so if we stick with newspapers, part of my vision is that we should encourage young people to read newspapers. I really do.
I don't think that's old-fashioned. I think it's radical. In print radical. Or online, digital versions count?
Yeah. The main thing is, for me, the important thing is it's not so much the medium. It's the idea that the truth is found again. So this is the truth bouncing back between. It's part two. Our need for each other, our diversity, our need for each other, and how that interacts with the truth. What's so amazing about newspapers, the newspapers that have been brilliant and are still brilliant, it's we didn't say, ooh, right, what we're going to do is we've got to get either some mix of chemicals or maybe some mix of metal, like we've got to build some sort of machine. I'm going to point it at Parliament, right? And with almost like these scientific rays, they're going to go into the Parliament and get the truth. So we're going to build a truth machine. Da-da, dun-dun-da. No. What we said was we're going to work together as human beings and we're going to roll up our sleeves and we're going to sweat and we're going to go out there.
Debate.
And we're going to sit down. We're going to make the politician or the business leader sit down in front of us and we're going to spend time with them. We're going to look them in the eye and we're going to keep asking questions and we're going to be awkward. And then we're going to go back to the office and we're going to sit down and decide which is the most important story of the day because, you know, poor Jimmy over here, Jimmy's spent half the day working on this story. It looks great, but the editor says, you know what, Jimmy, I'm sorry. We don't have space to you today because this... Our readers need to hear this today. This is more urgent. I'm exaggerating and inventing here, but what the point here is, it's human beings with all their frailties, and if you look at the great films about journalists over the last 100 years, they're not perfect beings. They're not saints. Yeah. We all know journalists who are not saints. There's something there. There's a lesson there. The vocation didn't attract saints. For me, that's normal. I get that. The gritty, determined journalist who sometimes bends the rules a little bit. Yeah. Because sometimes to get to the truth, you have to bend the rules.
And you have to do a lot of digging, as you have and continue to do. I want to just take a tangent of that, though, because when you alluded to working on a story, for example, and then there's no space for it because something else is primary. So that also gets, and truth is related to this, to the issue of using your journalistic metaphor, newsworthiness. We've got and have always had in our journalistic institutions, in every medium, we have gatekeepers, the editors, who decide what needs to be shared, what information, what stories are of prime interest and concern to the listeners, the public. And what I've noticed, having trained as a journalist eons ago, is that when I look at lead stories, for example, in Canada, that rank the first item on the news, the national news, there has been a huge change in what is considered primary. So now, and national news, and back to unifying, national news to me should be of interest to people across the country. And instead, what we're getting are local tragedies that, yes, they can be covered for the local community, but should they be the lead item? And I noticed in our country, a transition was based on the gatekeeper, and I know who they are. About 12 years ago, they did probably some focus group study, and they determined that the primary concern for Canadians was security and safety. So suddenly, our national news and our local news are regional, I'd say, and national, not local, was filled with, I don't know, car accidents and poisonings and things that were happening at a local level, but they related to safety and concern. That's bad enough because then you're missing the national news. You're not, to me, conveying what really is newsworthy that can affect and interest and engage others beyond those concerned about fires or whatever. But it's also preventing, because it's curating, what really could be unifying people. So the gatekeepers, newsworthiness, truth, pursuit of truth.
Yeah. Trust.
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 Exactly.
Fundamental. Trust.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we can't believe it.
Exactly. When you shared, you would like young people to read the newspaper, speaking as a relatively young person, the first thing that popped into my mind was, I don't want to read the newspaper because I don't know who's paying for this information to be shared with us and why.
Right.
So there already exists this lack of trust.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of work to be done.
A lot of work to
be
done.
Which is partly repair, but also starting afresh and learning from, if young people are disengaging, we need to understand why.
So it used to be that a prime vehicle for getting your news, your information out, in this case, your vision out, would have been doing media interviews because, you know, back to my old PR days, you would identify which media your target audience listened to or watched, and you would then speak to those journalists to get your message out, to have them carry it for you. But as Brittany, you've just said, how do you reach probably a demographic under 40 today, 35 anyways, right? Who, if you use a medium that to you historically has been traditional or valued or even trusted to a greater degree, and you've got a vehicle that others do not trust, they're not going to get it because they're not even going to be approachable to that.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Sure.
So getting it has a different level of complexity and precision now than I think it did before. Yep. And if you can't go through the media, if the general perception is you can't trust them, they're whatever, driven by other interests, et cetera, then where do you go?
I think you mentioned, this is getting a little bit into the nitty gritty, the detail, but we'll go there just for a second. You mentioned a very important word, curation.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult but also important part of the traditional newspaper, the idea that you wake up and you read something where the editor has already made all the big choices for you. Any person, I think, of any age would come across the idea, well, hang on, isn't it my job to go out there and choose what I want to read? Shouldn't I be making those choices? Yes, but you mentioned trust. This is not a perfect analogy, but there's something here. Our world has changed massively over the last 10, 20 years in its digital. So the digital world has ballooned and mushroomed and seeped into all parts of our lives. And this is even before we get to AI, which we've only briefly touched on, Marianne. But there's a principle where the restaurant, and I think if I look in this city, there are young people, even if they are just getting their first job or if they maybe still at university, they still want to go to a restaurant sometimes, even if they can afford to go once a month or once every 2 months. But the restaurant still has a draw. That's what I'm saying, has a pull. People are drawn to their favorite restaurants, favorite food. And so what's happening there, it's you go to a place that you trust. You go to a place where you know what you're going to get. You go to a place that sort of responds to you and what you're looking for. You go there with friends. So there's a lot of trust in there. And trust in the restaurant that we walk into, certainly in our big cities, we walk into, I don't know, 99% of restaurants, and we do get food poisoning sometimes, but it's rare. Mm-hmm. Like my sense, looking at friends and family, it happens, but it's still pretty rare. So there's something there about trust. Okay. What saddens me, and that's all I'm going to say, what saddens me sometimes is that we've lost this idea that when it comes to news, we go to the news restaurant, and we created these beautiful restaurants with great food, with great chefs and a great culture, and there was freedom involved because you could read what your mum and dad read, or you could say, no way, I want to read this newspaper. So there was choice. So for me, not that long ago, it was part of your identity. It was growing up, and I'm quite proud of reading this newspaper. other friends, you might think, ooh, I thought he was my friend, but he's reading that newspaper. So it was part of growing up and identity. And that was fun. And all I'm saying here is it just saddens me a little bit that the idea that, you know, we go to a chemist when we need ibuprofen, and we go to an Italian restaurant where we went, where we're not really good puttanesca. You know, if we want good running shoes, we go to a sports shop. So the fact that we suddenly decided, oh, for news, which is vital to our democracy and our ability to live together, and we talked about truth being life and death. It saddens me, and there's no judgment here. We need to work out how this happened, and it's too easy to say, well, social media, there's more. It's more than that, economic models. It's not only the internet, but it does sadden me that we created this beautiful shop for news with great people in it working really hard, producing lovely food called The Newspaper. That was the name of the shop. And we've just lost it a little bit. We're not completely. There are many newspapers fighting on bravely, and I don't see that. I'm fighting my own nostalgia here. I don't want this to be a sort of whimsical nostalgia to regain something. I just think it's absolutely vital. Absolutely vital.
That reminds me, John.
Whatever form it takes.
Absolutely. It's a foundation of our society. I remember when I was in high school, Watergate happened. Mm. And I was the editor of our high school newspaper, one of the newspapers, and my advisor formed a group of us and took us to New York, where she was from, and took us to Columbia University, where high school newspaper people were gathering. And I think it was because I was Canadian that I was asked to facilitate a conversation about Watergate, right in the heart of Watergate. And I remember, I mean, it was pretty contentious, because here we had these journalists, you probably know of them now, I'm looking at Brittany and Jean, because they've made films of them, and they're still around defending the truth, right? But I interviewed them, and it was a time in history where, I mean, it was, you know, we use the word unprecedented now. Why, everything's unprecedented, but it truly was that a president of the United States Nixon would have done something like that. So what happened, and the fact that we were at Columbia was not an accident. Columbia Journalism School, which was it and Northwestern in the States, were, in my view at the time, the best. I know at Columbia itself, the number of applicants for journalism school as a result of the Watergate investigation into truth skyrocketed. And I contrast that today, I hear that journalism schools cannot get students applying. And why? Back to you, Brittany, trust. So if that's where we're at, how do you get them to get it?
Right. It's one of those parts of the vision, and it's branches that will take time. There is no easy fix for this. We need to understand what's gone wrong, and we already know parts of the reasons, but maybe not all of it. But again, bringing it back to the vision, what seems important to me as a principle, a grounding principle, a starting point, is that the truth is not owned or produced by a machine. That's important. It doesn't stand there as a cold, black slab of truth, impregnable, and you just stand and look at it and, wow, that's the truth. This big, black slab of truth, not a speck of dust on it. It's perfect truth. No, it's part two. It's part two of the vision, which is human beings needing each other, working together to get to the truth and making mistakes. A big part of the journalistic code is that if you make a mistake,
You correct it. Rectify.
That's really important.
Doesn't that relate to your saying earlier, as one of the things they don't get, that this is not about perfection or perfectibility?
Yes, that's right.
We're allowed to make mistakes.
Absolutely. And the truth comes in is where it's hard to admit you've made a mistake sometime. It's often hard to admit mistakes. Yeah. But when you develop a culture of it, when it's welcomed, celebrated, then maybe there's hope that we can change.
Well, it's essential when you're creating the new, something that doesn't exist yet, that the people have permission the unknown to create and fail.
Yes.
And any innovative enterprise should be promoting that, and the best do. They give their employees of their corporate environment and entity permission to fail. Because if you don't have permission, if you know you're going to be penalized, sanctioned, terminated because you've tried something new that didn't work, why would you try?
Mm. Yeah.
So back to your vision of creating the new, give them permission.
Yes.
To not be perfect.
Yes. Yes. No, I think that's right. And I think that's also, that's the soil rather than the home itself.
The soil. Yeah.
You can't just build. It would be great if you just go and build the new home, the shared home. But the soil that you build it in is critically important. And often culture has to change first. Culture is often where we get the first sense of change, long before the actual institutions change.
Absolutely.
And also, just to finish with newspapers, just to round it up, there is also something here about sticking with part two of the vision, so the diversity. There's something wonderful for me about a great newspaper in the traditional sense, is that a good newspaper should comfort you. Ah, I was right about this. I like that. But also make you uncomfortable. Should also make you uncomfortable. And if I look at the newspapers I've read over the last 20 years, I've got my favorite writers who make me feel good and say, yeah, I've understood the word and you know, that's all good. But then sort of forcing yourself sometimes, and you have to, because it's not pleasant, the writers in the paper who you don't particularly like, who disrupt your vision, who just have a different worldview. And the idea that you have that together in the same newspaper, it's a simple thing. It's not radical. It's not a mind-blowing invention, but it is important. It is important. It introduces you to the idea that, you know, it can be a newspaper that says, we stand for the truth. We're not afraid of anybody. We stand for the truth, but we don't all sound the same.
Yeah. So, honoring our diversity rather than pandering
completely
one belief system.
It's exactly that. It's exactly that. So, you know, what do we stand for? We're not going to hide from anybody. We're not going to bow down to government. We're not going to be frightened by this corporate leader or this mafia boss. We're going to push it to the limit.
No matter what.
Yeah. We see this as life and death, but we don't all think the same. We're different.
So back to what don't they get? Do you think that there's a possibility that they may think, in hearing you start to speak about your vision, that you're intractable?
That's the risk, isn't it? That is a danger, that you that you're so, and if you're not careful with your language and not careful with your body language and your tone of voice, it's very easy to give the sense that this is the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
This is the vision. This is the way it's going to be, and we like conviction. Conviction's a good thing, but it's a fine line between conviction and some form of blindness where you're not looking up anymore. Your head's down, and you're pushing the vision through the door.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're adamant that it.
Yeah.
That they get it. Like,
sure.
You're so adamant.
Sure.
I love that you contrasted that as looking up versus looking down.
Yeah. Yeah. It's harder to walk head up and looking. It requires a bit more. Top models do it very well, but they train, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not aspiring to do that.
And you have, and that's why I'm pulling at this thread. You have said over this last conversation or several conversations, again, that it is together you're pursuing it. The truth, for example, we pursue it together. It's not just your truth, even though that vision, when you have a really big, compelling vision and it's always getting more and more evident to me that you see so many pieces of it, Jonathan, you know, you don't want to create, and you wouldn't, but it's what they could not maybe see, is that because you see it, you're not willing to, not bend, but that you are so determined to ignite it exactly as you see it, without any room for, not deviation, but embellishment or refinement or change, retraction. And you have spoken of your vision as a sphere and not a rigid thing.
Yes.
So could they initially not get that this is not, because you've said it is concrete. It's not just abstract. It is concrete. So when you go to the concrete and the practical, you also have to convey that this is a pursuit together to co-create together. Mm.
Yes, and this brings us to the word we, the importance of the word we.
Yes, and it's not the royal we, it's the we.
Yeah, it's the we. it's the great we of the op-ed. Going back to newspapers very briefly, that I've always been drawn to the op-ed that uses the we. I like the idea that the writer is trying to bring people in.
Yeah, you know. Inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did we do last week when we voted in this new government? Question mark. You know? So it's the we, bringing in the community.
Yeah.
And that's partly a linguistic technique, rhetoric,
yeah.
but it also speaks to a certain mind view as well.
And if you change that pronoun from we to you, imagine how accusatory that would, or blaming that could be.
Absolutely.
What did you do to bring in?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how much of the far right's language is they.
Yes.
Did they listen to you? Did they ask for your opinion?
Yeah.
Those people there.
Did they think of you when they?
Yeah. Do they care about you?
Yeah. No. So we removes any separation.
It removes separation. It's a call to come together. It's so many things, if it's done well, and it can be too sugary, too schmaltzy, it can be too overbearing. It can be too overbearing, yeah?
In what way, overbearing?
Well, you know, this guy, I don't think people would consciously say this, but at the back of their minds, unconsciously, he keeps going about we. I've not signed up for this yet. You know, I like some of these ideas, but, you know, I don't want the T-shirt.
Or the authority figure.
So again, how, as with anything, how you do it, the intention, the posture, the language is critical. But we is, it is an important part of the language.
Well, yeah. And it's critical to your vision.
Yeah, it
the
is.
We.
It is really. And that the we, honestly, at its most radical level, looking at the world today, that we is still possible. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm pitching for.
Ah, voilà.
That's what I'm...
Absolutely.
That is still possible.
Still possible.
Yeah.
Well, there is something they may not get right now.
Right,
how
sure.
can we be possible?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
When you feel so disenfranchised.
Absolutely.
So can I repeat a couple of things
please,
you said?
Yeah, please do.
Back to the question of what don't they get about this? You have said, more eloquently than this, I will admit, that they don't get that this isn't abstract, that it's more concrete, there are practical ways. That this is about all of us, not about perfectibility, as we said, and it's not a race to the truth. It's a pursuit of the truth. They may not get that. They also may not get that this is something for them. And they may not get that, back to perfectibility, that they have permission to fail.
Which brings us to, that's part two. And it strikes me that part two is perhaps going to be the hardest part to express in language, because it is inherently complex. I think all parts of, for the sake of this discussion, let's say our democracies, our Western democracies, Europe, North America, just for this conversation, I think we have all become, whatever our views, I think we've all been exposed over the last I was going to say last 10, 20 years, I'd say the last century or more, to debates and political campaigns and legislative progress, I'm happy to say, on issues of race and gender. So that visible diversity, whatever our views on it and however we feel about it, it's become a part of our vernacular. It's become part of our day-to-day politics. And that's good. I think part two is going to be challenging for me to find the right words, because the diversity that's within us.
Part one being?
Part one is dignity and freedom.
Okay.
Part two is our diversity within us. So the idea that we are so diverse and also incomplete and a little shattered and broken from birth, and that we find our way to a fuller life. That's all I'm struggling at. But through each other.
Okay.
So that our need for each other is not only out of love and friendship and camaraderie and through solidarity, through our social networks, through the welfare state. Yes, it's more than that. It's that at the human level, we need each other to become our true selves and the best of ourselves.
Okay, at the human level.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then part three,
is
to clarify.
The truth.
Okay. And this isn't a hierarchy in terms of ranking of value or importance.
It's a three.
They're equal, right?
They are equal. There is part of me feels that truth comes in at the end and also wraps itself around the whole and protects it in some way. That it has a special role, and that the dignity, you know, I said the dignity of each child, that inviolable dignity that every child has and doesn't have to earn, and is unique and sacred. I said earlier, I think that's the core of the core of the core of the core. And it is, it's everything.
Excellent.
Everything builds around that. And truth, I'm not sure what the right image is, whether it's truth protecting. To be honest, I think it's more, I prefer truth as good, clean, fresh air, actually.
Truth as good, clean, fresh air.
You know, again, even smokers know that fresh air tastes good. I say that as a former smoker. So fresh air could appeal. I wouldn't.
You have a very unique perspective on truth, I have to say. Truth is good, clean,
I just think, you know, on a serious note, if you look at what Europe is being reminded of at the moment, is the need for a much stronger protection. Where things feel very worrying at the moment is that we may have fallen asleep or gotten used to our security over the last 50, 60 years. And I say it's not that we forgot, like you forget something in the supermarket, but maybe took it for granted.
Yeah.
Took it for granted, we suddenly realized that, you know, if your democracy is your heart and your lungs and your liver and your brain, mm-hmm. in the human body, they are all protected by really hard bone, yeah, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
and it's as if we'd forgotten that these vital organs need protection. They don't protect themselves.
So if I think of good, clean, fresh air, I'd love some right now, personally.
Yeah,
there's
there
a gorgeous
go.
Park right outside. Yeah. However, I find it revitalizing. Mm. So if truth is good, clean, fresh air, is truth revitalizing?
Yes, I think it should be. I mean, it's not the perfect analogy. It's not the perfect image. But I like what you say there, because I think, you know, history, it's tempting to see history as dusty books in a school classroom, dusty books in a library being taught by a dusty teacher. We know that that's not true. We know that history never stops. But what I would say is history needs to be revitalized in that it needs to be challenged. Again, new evidence. When new evidence comes, we have to change our history. And if we see that some telling of an episode was wrong, we have to have the courage to change our own history. If it's on the basis of evidence, new research, new witnesses, yeah. So that's where the truth is revitalizing.
Yeah, in terms of
history.
Okay, but what about on the human level? You've spoken about fragmentation, fracturing, whatever. Mm. So could the truth be revitalizing to the human and the human condition, the human spirit, in your vision?
I think there is something demanding about it. And this is the fresh air that maybe catches your breath a little bit. This is back to the sphere again. Mm-hmm. I feel that in part one, in the idea of the dignity, there is something warm and soft and innocent there, symbolized by the child, but it's not exclusive to the child. The child is a symbol in some way. Part two, there is the warmth of collaboration, working together, cooperation, teamwork, that we need each other. There's a warmth there, which is important. Part of me thinks that in part three, the truth, there is a necessary breath of fresh air, as if to say, if we want these good things, if we want to keep the warmth, you don't just keep the radiator on.
Right.
It's a bit more complicated than just keeping the radiator on the whole year. Mm-hmm. No, sometimes you need to open the window for all sorts of different reasons. Sometimes you need to go out and get fresh air, and sometimes it's a bit fresh and sometimes it's a bit cold, but it's there for a good reason.
Okay, I'm not giving up on this one,
yeah,
though. So if the human condition, the state of the world, is that, I know you know this to be true, in starting to evoke your vision, if you are doing so within a state, a prevalent state of people, as you spoke earlier yesterday, the condition they're in right now, everything from cynicism, distrust, all of those things.
Yes, apathy.
Yeah, exactly. Why should they care? Why should they even care to listen, for example? So if you're now saying, back to your perception and your value for truth, if you're saying truth is like fresh air, and if we extrapolate that fresh air can be revitalizing, I just looked up the definition of revitalizing, tending to impart new life and vigor to something. Mm-hmm. So could that help? I'm looking for the spark for you, for that spark to help ignite your vision. Could that be through truth?
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah?
I like it because, again, it's getting away from the idea of truth as a slab of stone.
Right.
And we bow down before the truth.
Yeah.
Either a big book or a big stone that we genuflect before.
And, yeah.
And it's there, impenetrable, hard, and you just have to accept it. Mm-hmm. You know, that idea of truth, and only some people can see it.
Yeah.
All of that's just awful, terrifying. So there is, we talked about the need for air. We talked about the need for the vision to be porous. Yeah. It's finding that shape and tension. And we've gone with a sphere so far where there is strength in the design.
Is it supple as well as strong?
Yes. I talked about give. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Supple.
Yes. Because if the vision is true to itself, it will correct itself. And again, I wanted to underline this earlier. I forgot. When we say these things and we talk about the suppleness of it and that it has to give, and now truth as fresh air, I want to be very clear. This is not about diluting the vision. It's not about looking for common denominators. This is where the vision needs to do some heavy lifting. Yeah, actually. So this depends on the design of the vision, but also the commitment of the people to keep it going in the future. The vision does heavy lifting in the sense that it's able to challenge itself. This is not an ideological vision that will find itself in a book written, one version of the book that every school kid needs to learn, for example. No. There is something built into the vision that says we can never be sure. That part three of the vision is not saying, this is it, we've got the truth now. Everybody can stop looking for the truth. We've got the truth. Hurrah.
So there the distinction is, it's emphatic,
yeah,
but it's not absolute.
That's a very good way of putting it. Yes, emphatic, full of energy. I think celebratory, you know, celebrating the people who get to the truth, celebrating those people across our community. And it could take all sorts of, I've just given the most obvious examples, yeah. From the journalists to the judges, to the juries, the scientists. As I said earlier, it's for everybody. It's a way of life. Mm-hmm. And it's not about always, again, it's not about saying we must always tell the truth and mm-hmm. we should feel very bad if we don't tell the truth. No. It's the pursuit of the truth. It's the celebration of it as an ideal of something that we seek and look for. Every artist in some way, even the most anarchical, rebellious artist, is searching for a truth in some way. Their truth.
And one that they hope others will appreciate,
yeah,
see,
yes,
recognize.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Do you see that in this card, as in the previous ones, you are identifying what could impede others from hearing you, first of all,
absolutely,
and understanding you?
Yes.
This card in particular, what don't they get? It addresses the understanding of the concepts, and these are big concepts. So when you can start to surface what they might not get, it allows you the opportunity to embellish where necessary, to define, just as we have defined words all the way along, define truth, for example, where you see there's a need to do that because their understanding of truth is different from yours.
Mm. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's go back to summarize, go back to the question and read it again, please.
So card 35, what don't they get about this? What don't they get? To communicate so that others hear us and understand us, we must see where our choice of words could impede us. Do they get your vision? If not, how can you express it differently so that they really do? This is where the vision really starts to come to life for me.
Good.
In the human sense of conversation, seeing people's reaction, listening to their reaction, listening to their objection, watching them fall asleep at that human level, but also the search for the right language and being very open to the idea that a particular word or a value that is so precious to you can simply not resonate with somebody else.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean you've lost them. That doesn't mean you've lost them. And we've discussed so many different ways in which they might be turned off, distracted, bored, worried.
Cynical. Worried, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Scared,
yeah. By a particular word.
Even triggered.
Triggered, yes. And so we talk to suppleness. I come back to suppleness. There is a suppleness of language, but also the suppleness of, there is something here about, there has to be suppleness in the idea as well. Because I think, Marianne, where we would agree here is that that there isn't a hard thing that we're trying to sell, for want of a better word. I'm going to put it in very plain language at the moment, you know, trying to sell an idea. We're trying to sell an idea, which is there. We know what it is. But we're going to have to do a bit of trickery with the words, use different words for these people and different words for those people to get past that. That's not what we're saying here.
No, and there's not a lot of integrity in that.
No.
And you use the word trickery, Jonathan, and that's sadly the state now, isn't it? Really? Let's spin. I hated that word in public relations, spin, you know. Spin the truth, basically. Spin the message so it captures them or deludes them or deceives them, but gets them to respond in the way you need. That's not what this is about.
No.
The messaging has to have integrity to impart the truth, their truth, your truth.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And on top of that, there is also, if we go right back to the beginning of this conversation, when we first started this, the previous card or even the card before that, there is that first moment of conversation where the vision is voiced, expressed for the first time, and somebody else receives it, hears it for the first time. And at that moment, at that precise moment, the vision is already changed. That's really important. There's a human...
Because they have a different filter system.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So that's something that any communicator in any field needs to accept. It's a difficult truth. It's a hard truth. The thing that you've worked on and labored over and polished and fine-tuned and packaged and got ready, at the moment it reaches the audience, it's changed. In that instant, they take hold of it in some way. Whatever they do with it, you don't know immediately. They may reject it, they may fall asleep, they may rework it in their own mind, but it's already changed. It's already changed. And it's not just the words, but the concepts behind them. So you're already dealing with something which is more supple.
Exactly.
And fluid.
And could you liken that to your metaphor of today we break with the past, new ground, new soil. We build a new ground together. New soil is part of that ground. So if you take that imparting of the vision, the first iteration of your vision, if it were a seedling, you're putting it in new soil, the new soil being the conditions that you help to create that will enable that seedling to thrive and ultimately grow into something stronger in the various branches of your vision.
Yes, yes. And that's where that speaks to, I think, what values are. Values are not a recipe. They're not a list of ingredients and a list of instructions that produce certain outcomes. Yeah. They are ideas that shape attitudes, shape ideas, shape behavior ultimately. And so there is suppleness built into it. If we go back to the collective at the beginning, there is a looseness amongst this first group of people. Nuances, different words, different preferences over words, maybe different languages, different cultural backgrounds, different histories. That's all good, provided that what is binding us for now is enough.
I have one last question.
Sure.
So going into this knowing that your audience is going to be interpreting your vision and your message through their own filter, can you pinpoint something, as we've touched on emotion several times, is there something that you can pinpoint? And I have an idea, but I'm curious to see what you come to, that you could lead with when you are engaging with them and sharing your vision, where doesn't necessarily matter the filter through which they perceive it or receive it through, because you are emitting something that they can feel, that they are receiving on a more physical and emotional level.
Rather than through their heads?
Mm. Yes.
My gut reaction here is that perhaps right up front there is a moment of recognizing shared suffering, perhaps, that you start there.
That together you're not living the ideal right now.
Yeah, yeah.
I do believe that suffering is the common thread that does unify all of these different demographics, for example, this diversity.
Mm.
But when you were speaking about the fresh breath of air.
Yeah.
And bringing your vision to life.
Yeah.
You became so animated.
Yeah.
And the energy that you were exhibiting in that moment was inspiration.
Okay.
You were deeply inspired in that moment.
Right.
And what I'm implying is that if you step on a stage or if you write, however you decide you'd like to reach your audience,
yeah,
and they can feel your inspiration, it's not going to specifically matter because they're going to feel you and they're going to know, I can get behind this.
Can you define what you mean by inspiration?
If we look at the word inspire from its roots, inspire, it's to inhale, to breathe in fresh life. And the way that I relate to that word is spirit in action. So inhaling, if you want to use the word energy, spirit, but it's something that moves you and moves through you. And as soon as you said this fresh breath of air that brings life to your vision, immediately the word inspiration came to me.
And it was connected to his use of truth as fresh
exactly.
Air.
Yeah. So,
which also has integrity, Jean. Do you see how this all weaves together?
It's all correlated. Inspired truth is what will fuel your vision.
Mm. Yep. That rings true.
And you can do that, yes?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Words matter to leaders. What you say to those who can help ignite your change has a huge bearing on if and how they'll respond, even when their role demands that they should. Jonathan has been long conscious of the importance of words. As the chief speechwriter to the former president of the European Union, he even made his living by them. Nevertheless, this conversation heightened his awareness of the critical need to choose words wisely and precisely. He sees that the words that matter most to him and that are central to his vision could distract or even repel others. Sacred dignity, diversity, truth. He doesn't want to seem like a pious moral authority. So he's got to convey the value of pursuing truth together and emphasize the we over I. At the end of this conversation, he gave new meaning to the expression, a breath of fresh air, and found a source of inspiration. The leader's journey continues. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the Leader's Journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.